Well, 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 hello, ladies and gentlemen, and good evening. The MSS crew is back on the attack here in the Fred Bertelsen Memorial Old Time Radio Room of RadioOutOfThePast.org. Today's date is Saturday, May 14th, 2016, and this is your super awesome, super smooth operating host of MSS, Luis Jr., assisting with bringing to you another exciting and ultra-exhilarating internet broadcast of Miguel's Saturday Night Surprise. Yes, folks, we are back, as promised, hooking you up with the thing that you come here to enjoy the most, and that is super solid, super smooth OTR surprises. So, without any further delays, I would just like to introduce our presenter for tonight's program, and he just so happens to be an all-star of OTR, one of the original four horsemen of OTR, and on top of that, he is one super rotten mother canucker, Rotten Rick Spurgeon. Yes, if you didn't guess it before that, then there might be a little something wrong with you. If all of you could just sit back, relax, and grab your favorite drinks and snacks, because Rotten Rick, the microphone is yours.
I love to listen to my radio. Gee, how it thrills me when I hear it go.
Good morning, kiddies.
That's when I think of you.
Well, thanks, Luis, and hi again, folks. Time to be back here for another hour of Rotten Ricky at the radio. Okay, Luis, you can... Yeah, it's all right. You want to go back with grace. I understand that. It's that time of life, so... You go ahead, and we'll call you when we're ready for you in about an hour or so, if you can stay awake that long. For the rest of us, I think we have an interesting show lined up. I don't often say that, especially when like this that came together accidentally, but even I liked it. And if I like something, that's usually unusual. Usually unusual. Well, let's carry forward before I get more backward. Tonight we're going to have some interviews with the stodgy old conservative CBC, the Canadian Radio Broadcasting Commission, as it used to be. Don't run away. They're actually pretty good. We're going to start off with an interview from the 90s with Vicky Gabriel, a chap who has an occupation I'd never heard of. Probably you haven't either. And when you hear the subject matter, you're going to say, yuck. But before it's over, you're changing that yuck into yuck, or even a yuck-yuck. He is a scatologist, if I remember correctly. And, well, I think the best thing to do is to play it. Like I say, don't be turned off at first. Run it through, because you'll be glad you did.
Well, tell me this. I'm going to try and not be coy throughout this interview. I know it must be a tendency when people find out what it is that you do. I'm going to try and not make obvious jokes. I'm going to try and conduct this in the most sensible way possible. If I fall down, I know you'll point it out. Okay?
Yep.
All right. You're a paleoscatologist. If you had a conference, would you be the only one there?
Well, probably, yes. There aren't many paleoscatologists. It depends on what conference it was, but most archaeological conferences that I attend, there are very few of us on the ground. But there is an association, an international association, called the Paleopathology Association, which accumulates people from all over the globe who've got an interest in ancient aspects of disease and bodies and the way people lived and died. And there'd be three or four of us.
There'd be three or four of you in that entire larger grouping, but in this specific one.
At any one meeting, yes. I think there's probably about, I can count up about a dozen people throughout the world who really work actively in this field.
You didn't make up this title, though. A paleoscatologist is a real thing.
Well, I mean, it's difficult to know, isn't it? Well, who made it up? You have to coin a phrase sometimes. People say, what do you do? And you can say, well, I look at ancient excrement. Mm. And people say, what? And I say, well, would say, give me a better name than that. What sort of... And you have to come up with a term. So I think I might be responsible for paleoscatologist. Yeah, it's possible. I've also coined the term paleoethnoparasitologist.
Holy Dinah. Mm. So you're looking for parasitic... What?
Eggs.
That's what we're looking for.
Parasitic worms is the evidence that we get. But
how
it's
lovely.
It's proper science. It isn't a load of old nonsense. It's not an invention. This isn't a game.
I know.
It's a really serious piece of scientific work. And if you look carefully at archaeological deposits, the right sort of deposits, and using the right methods, you can find plenty of evidence of parasites.
How would you define, given you were at a cocktail party and someone said, what do you do, which seems to be a common occupation of people, I'm a paleoscatologist, and then they say, what is that? Then how do you define it?
Well, you say it's somebody who's got an interest in looking at ancient latrine deposits and the parasites and gut contents associated with ancient human bodies.
Mm. And do people run from you, or are they then gripped by the potential of conversation?
I've not had anybody run off. I've had occasionally given public lectures and people have left the room. That has happened. But usually people think it's just so weird that there's anybody who really earns their living doing this and studies this subject seriously and writes papers and articles about it, that they're really intrigued. Because the one thing that's important, you see, that you've got to remember, is that all of us, doesn't matter who you are, all of us care about excrement and feces. It's a really, really important thing. It's fundamental to human life and human well-being. We all have an interest in it. We all share the same bodily functions. So consequently, there's a point of contact with all humanity. And it doesn't matter whether you're talking to small children who are maybe 4 or 5 years of age, mm-hmm. or elderly retired people. Everybody knows what you're talking about, and everybody can relate to it. And it's safe enough when you're talking about ancient stuff. So
yes.
It's sort of removed, so it's not so nasty. I mean, I wouldn't want to go up to people and interview them and talk to them about the consistency of their recent feces or today's.
I
would draw a line there.
I'm sure that you would admit that we seem to be, Westerners that is, obsessed with pretending it doesn't happen. We don't want to really talk about it. We don't really want to know that we do this. Now this has got to be new.
It is absolutely. You're perfect. You've really hit an important point here, and you're absolutely right. We are obsessed by trying to get away from it and pretend it doesn't happen. And if you look back in time and the evidence, archaeological evidence, which comes in two forms, really. There's some historical data that are available, but also if you look at the architecture of latrines, you will find from the earliest ones, including the Roman ones, they were a big communal system. People didn't have any sense of privacy or needing privacy when they performed their normal bodily functions. And it wasn't until probably somewhere in about the 13th century that the whole idea of people needing to go and be private when they went to the lavatory or relieved themselves, that idea came in. And then only amongst the highest echelons of Western society. And so gradually those ideas spread through the other social strata until today most of us have very strange ideas. But if you go to lots of different parts of the world today,
yes.
you will find that people don't have these hangouts. They don't. And if you look, for example, a lot of monastic architecture, you find about that time the big medieval multi-seat latrines go out of use and you start to get in place smaller one-seat privies. And that's all working through society, but certainly people had a different attitude to bodily functions, and it's really in this fairly recent times that we get really uptight. I think it's got a lot to do with the numbers of people that live together. And you know, I was reading on the London Underground today, and you can understand why people take a bit of care about how they smell.
Yes,
and you know, I mean, it's really, really unpleasant to be crushed in the way we are crushed in modern urban life, and if you have smelly people in there. Smelling unpleasant, I mean, rather than perfumes and more pleasant odours, then I think it makes perfect sense. And of course, things like the Underground just didn't exist in the even in the 15th or 18th century.
Yes, but they used to fling buckets of crap out the window.
They did, but why was that? Now, this is a really interesting point you've raised here. The reason why that was acceptable behaviour was to do with the way that Tudor people, medieval people, had what their view of the world was. And this all goes back to the ancient Greeks, to the Aristotelian view of the cosmos. It's a really big idea, this. In this scenario, what you have is human beings on the earth, and as you go progressively out from the earth, you go through the sky and the clouds, through the stars and the moon, through the sun, and you get more and more rarefied as you go out. So the world is composed of concentric spheres, and the further out you got, the more holy and more pure things were, and where all light and truth came from. So eventually, at the absolute extremity of the cosmos, in people's mind, was God. Okay? Mm. And progressively, as you got towards the world, there was more and more corruption and filth and sort of horribleness until you got down to the world. And of course, the consequence of that is that the world, the earth that people live on, is the real cesspit of the cosmos. So, if that's the all filth and depravity is concentrated on the earth, it's perfectly acceptable just to throw it outside or dump it in pits and just ignore it, because people, medieval spires, were all searching for the truth and goodness which was outside the earth. So that's why that was acceptable behavior.
Now, can you pretty well spot in an archaeological dig, for example, if you were to come to Llansow Meadows, the World Heritage Park in Newfoundland, mm-hmm. Which is an old Viking encampment.
Yeah, I know. Well,
have you been there?
No, I'd love to go.
Let's go.
I've seen slides and things, so I'd love to go.
Now, would you have a pretty good idea right off the bat where the latrine was, and you'd head there first?
No, you wouldn't have I wouldn't have a very good idea. I think the people who dug there might have a pretty good idea. But what you find on Viking Age sites, or what we found on Viking Age sites, is that this idea of filth being concentrated just in latrine pits is actually rather anomalous. It's true that the people did dig pits and deliberately tried to dispose of their feces in an orderly manner. But the evidence that we've got from excavations in York and elsewhere is that the living conditions were pretty squalid, and it's what we were talking about earlier, all this filth being thrown out of windows and dumped in yards and so forth. And even contemporary medieval accounts show us that there were real problems with people's cesspits overflowing and the filth flowing into somebody else's basement. I mean, really, really vile things went on. So consequently, what you have is an enormous amount of fecal contamination. And if you add to that indiscriminate defecation by kids and maybe people having accidents and so forth and pots being dropped, it's not surprising that you can look almost anywhere in soil samples where they're decent, where there's decent waterlogged preservation, and you'll find a few parasite eggs. And the art of the paleo scatologist is to sort the sheep from the goats, really, because in a lot of samples you find small numbers of eggs, but they are really just related to the general level of filth and squalor that people lived under. And our job is to really pick out the juicy ones.
What happens if you get an 800-year-old sample?
The first thing is to establish whether it's excrement or not, because it's really hard to tell. You can't just pick up a lump of earth and say, oh, that's a lump of excrement, because it could be almost anything.
Well, how do you know? I mean, you can't know. You could be just picking up lumps of dirt for the rest of your life.
It's by doing that process I've just outlined.
Yes.
Putting it under a microscope and finding the eggs. Now, having found these parasite eggs and measured them and been absolutely confident of what sort they are, you can then go on and do a whole range of sieving techniques and bits of analysis on other material from the same layer and talk about, find out about diet, find out about the animals people were eating, and other aspects of everyday life.
What were they eating 400 years ago, 500 years ago?
Wow, do you mean 400 or 500? You see, we've refined this work to such an extent that there are differences between what people were eating in those periods. And there are remarkable changes in diet, certainly in a place like York, from the period that it was first occupied in the Roman era.
Tell me everything.
For example, in the Roman period, what you find is you get a lot of bran of cereals, largely wheat bran, and you get occasionally exotic foods like figs and grapes, pips, things like that occur in most fecal deposits in the Roman period. And all of the, and with a few exotic herbs and spices. By contrast, when you get into the Viking Age in the 10th century, grapes and figs just don't occur at all. There was no international trade or possibly horticulture growing those species in Britain. And instead, what you find is people were much more reliant on wild fruits, like wild cherries and small plums and damsons and things like that.
Did they eat the pits half the
time?
Yeah,
that's it. Yeah, that's what we find. And this, all this business about sticking stuff around the plate, never in the past. People just bolted it all down straight through the digestive system. That's just how it's always been. And similarly, people have not been precious about the kinds of fish that they've eaten. And when they eat fish, they swallow the whole animal, bones and all.
And the tiny head?
Yeah, everything, everything. Head bones a lot.
Tails. Well, how the heck do you know whether somebody ate a whole fish or not? How do you, what do you find in there that makes you know that they ate a fish head?
Well, you find the eye lenses.
Oh, for God's
sake. I tell you the
I mean,
truth.
When you find an eye lens, you must think, what is this, a contact lens? I mean, you've got to know.
No, they're fish's eyes are the lenses in fish's eyes, like the lenses inside our eyes, are spherical, so you find these small spheres. But you find those. There's no question that people are swallowing whole animals, yeah.
Isn't that amazing?
And you also find the jaw bones and other bits of the head bones, as well as the vertebrae and traces of fins and so forth, yeah.
What a piece of work we really are. And you know, you leave your mark no matter how you try to cover your tracks, don't you?
Yes. Yeah, I think actually it's harder today with our highly processed foods. I guess that quite a lot of the stuff that we're eating, you'd have to use some pretty elaborate techniques to detect what the food components were, because some foods are so highly refined. It's only when people have a diet which is based on locally available foods that are often not highly processed that you get the evidence of the bits of husk.
All right, parasites. I just want to... I guess we don't have too many parasites in the West now.
Well, that's not entirely true, actually. There are still quite a lot of parasites. We have both internal parasites. In particular, there's a small white worm called the human pinworm, which is Latin name is Enterobius, which is still quite common in this country. I don't know about the its occurrence in Canada, but I'd be surprised if it wasn't there.
I can't imagine that we have anything like that here.
Oh, no. I bet you do. I bet you do. I think you're just too polite to mention it. But it's still very common in this country amongst youngsters, children. And, of course, ectoparasites in the form of head lice are associated with clean hair rather than dirty hair. So they are still a problem.
I'm itchy already. But when you root through this stuff, at your samples and so on, what kind of parasitic infestation do you see? Rampant? Everybody, every sample's got some sign of it?
Yes, is the answer to that. Yes, absolutely rampant. They're different species from the ones I've just described. The nematode worm, the Enterobius. What we find in archaeological deposits is lots of evidence for a beast called Trichuris, or the whipworm. And this is an animal that grows to about 5 centimetres in length and occurs in very large numbers in the lower intestine. It snuggles in between the undulations in the intestine and lives there happily. And it's a brilliant place to live. If you're a worm, you just imagine it. Just imagine being a worm.
Mm.
The intestine is a fabulous environment to inhabit because you've got it nice and moist, it's warm, you're very well protected, and all this food just comes waddling down past you. All you have to do is sit there.
Sheer perfection.
Absolutely heaven, I think, for lots of organisms. The one problem that you've got if you're a parasite living in somebody's intestines is that it is quite difficult to meet mates, meet partners, and have progeny.
Yes.
So what these animals do is invest a huge amount of their energy in producing eggs and sperm so that they can keep this species going.
Lovely.
And that's why they're such a brilliant thing for archaeologists, because they produce so many eggs that you get a gram of feces can contain often 100,000 ova parasite eggs. that's a fairly large number, but you can get that concentration. And frequently, I mean, most infections will give you about 1,000 over per gram of fresh feces. So there's a huge number of eggs, and these things get spread all over the place, you see, and that they become trace fossils that allow us to trace the extent of human excrement on archaeological sites.
I'm Michael Enright, and this is Rewind, where you never know what you'll hear. It's all from CBC Radio's past, and today it's unusual, funny, or in this case, fascinatingly weird moments. Vicki Gabbro is talking to Dr. Andrew Jones, a man who studies ancient human excrement. Yes, really.
I wanted to know if we could talk about accoutrement associated with elimination.
Yes, why not?
I'm getting more delicate as this
hour. You are, actually. I'm rather disappointed.
I'm going to let you go for the really good words.
Okay.
All right. Toilet paper. When did we get that?
I don't know, actually.
Oh, fine. Well, goodbye then.
No. What I can tell you, though, is what the Romans used. Mm. The Romans used Mediterranean bath sponges that we still harvest today.
Mm-hmm.
And we've got some examples of this from latrine deposits in York. It's a really interesting story because we found this stuff and recognized it as sponge and sent it off to the Natural History Museum in London for identification. And the person who looked at it said, hey, this is amazing. You've got some sponge here. This is the first time we've known of this kind of thing coming up in archaeological deposits. So we wrote back and said, well, we're really thrilled by this because this is associated with excrement, and this is the first time that we've known anything about it. And then we got a letter back saying, oh, this is interesting. I didn't know the Romans used this for wiping their bottoms. Now, this is extraordinary to me, because here's a person who'd spent their entire academic career studying sponges, knew them top to tail, but was not aware that the Romans used them for wiping their bums, which is interesting. Then in the Viking period, where we've done a lot of work, what we find is moss, huge
yes.
amounts of moss that was gathered. And often my botanical colleagues have been going through these handfuls of moss, because you really do get them in latrine pits, which are all squidgy and full of excrement. You get a solid handful of moss, sometimes richly impregnated with human excrement.
You must and be in heaven.
You can really imagine somebody taking a handful and wiping their bottoms and then throwing it in.
I'm picturing it right now, I can tell you.
You can't get away from it. But if you look carefully at these moss pollsters, what you find in some of them are fragments of other plants like holly leaves.
Oh, that's very foolish.
Now, this really does have a serious implication.
Doesn't it?
To imagine that you've got Viking chaps going out into the woods, or they could be Viking ladies, going out into the woods, gathering loads of moss from the woodland floor and bringing it back to Viking Jorvik, and in the long winter evenings sorting it into two piles, the nice smooth stuff and not so smooth stuff, and then they go around houses next door and say, anyone want some moss? We've got two grades, cheaper or more.
Did you pick up some moss on the way home, dear? The thing is, you know, I was just going to put, it's no wonder you didn't know exactly when we took on toilet paper, because I think the British only figured it out in about 1975. I mean, why? Where? Who? Anybody? I mean, if we come from a long line of moss users, why the producers of toilet paper in your country, or loo paper as you call it, yeah. would wax one side is beyond my understanding.
Well, it makes it go further, I think.
I guess that you could
last
be right.
longer. And also, you can the waxy stuff, you can put on a comb and you can hum and make tunes on it, which you can't with the softer stuff that's not so useful for multiple purposes. And you can't use it as tracing paper. I mean, I went to school, and lavatory paper was what we used all the time for tracing paper.
Uh-huh. Andrew Jones, million laughs. What about diapers? What do we know anything, or what do you call them, nappies?
Nappies, yes. Now, that's a really interesting question, and also sanitary towels for women,
yes.
too. We really don't know much about this either. It is possible that moss was used for that purpose, but we're not absolutely certain. There have been some attempts to look for the evidence of menstrual blood in archaeological deposits, but those have not proved successful.
I wonder why.
Well, I think it's very difficult to identify the proteins after such a long time and be certain that that's what you're dealing with.
Hmm. Tell me about your relationship with Lloyds Bank. What is that story?
Well, Lloyds Bank is, as you know, an international banking company of some standing. And we were asked, the York Archaeological Trust was asked in 1972 to carry out some excavations in advance of them converting a building into a bank, and they wanted us to essentially take out the soil so that they could put in vaults, bank vaults, underneath the building. And so we went in and dug four small holes for them, and at the bottom of one of these holes we found this amazing coprolite, or stool. It's a, well, we call it the Lloyds Bank turd. It is the best preserved piece of mineralized, almost fossilized,
yes,
human excrement that I have ever seen. It's really an exciting discovery.
Well, how big is it?
It's about 8 inches long. It's slightly flattened, but it's pointed at both ends. You can really feel the the evacuation, the sphincter muscles opening, and then this wonderful
Andrew,
stool
you're going
passing,
mad,
and then the sphincter closing, and a really satisfying delivery. So it's a brilliant, brilliant find. And because it was found on the site known as Lloyds Bank, and Lloyds Bank sponsored and support archaeology well in Britain, it's been known as the Lloyds Bank turd for years. Now, for some time, this thing was known as a Viking Age stool, but recent work suggests that it's probably a bit earlier. It's over 1,000 years old. But it is a marvellous piece, a marvellous find. And the people in Lloyds Bank love it too. It's really good, because radio people and newspaper people sometimes find out about it and then go to the bank and say, hey, what do you think about this? What do you think about a bank being associated with a lump of human excrement? And the chaps over there
we
really
love it. They love it.
They love it. They think it's wonderful. And this is one of the things I think that archaeology can do. It is a subject that is relevant to all aspects of our society and community today. And it helps to build bridges, because it's to do with things about people, everyday life, and how people survived and what they did. Whereas history, by contrast, tends to be dominated with concern about the wealthy and the great, the armies, people like that. And that's not everybody, you know. They've all been children, they've all had to eat, they all go to the lavatory. And that's where archaeology, I think, has its strength.
Just tell me this. Does Lloyds Bank have it mounted in their head office?
No, they don't. We've got it mounted at the Archaeological Resource Centre.
Have you
it's
really?
A wonderful thing. Yes, the Archaeological Resource Centre is a radical new approach to museums, in that instead of putting things behind glass cases, all the objects we've got are out on benches for people to pick up and investigate in whatever way they see fit. And the centrepiece of one of our exhibits is the Lloyds Bank turd. And that is the single most important object we have on show. So I think this is really a nice thing, that whereas in most museums you'll get a lovely gold chalice or something of that kind, we've got a piece of excrement as our centrepiece.
What a bunch of fun guys. Now here's the thing. What did you do with it when you got it? Now I know you've described the process, but you didn't want to dismantle it, did you? Because it wouldn't have that same lovely shape.
Well, so we had to. I'm afraid truth prevailed. What we had to do was that we found it and we didn't know what it was. It was a mystery. It was a really hard lump, and it looked as though it could have been some kind of industrial slag or industrial residue of some sort. So we decided the only thing to do was to break it open and to examine samples of it under a microscope. That's what we did. We had to use some dilute acid to break it up, but that's precisely what we did, and found eggs of the Trichuris worm that I just told you
yes.
about, but also another parasite which is in fact more horrible than Trichuris, a worm called Ascaris, which is still very mm-hmm. common in parts of the world today.
Did somebody really send you camel dung by the mail? And
yes,
why not? I mean, why I find that so extraordinary, I don't know.
That's right. I've got camel dung from Egypt. Yes, I've got that. I've got some 70,000-year-old hyena droppings from caves in southern France. All sorts of material.
Who opens your mail?
Well, I usually do.
Good.
Yeah, I think it's good. I really like opening it. I think it's really exciting to receive samples. I've even got some Thai dog droppings.
As a child, did you know you were going to do this? I mean, it's like, I think I'll grow up and play the violin.
I had no idea what I'd do when I was a kid, really. I was brought up on a farm in Devonshire, in southwest England, and so I was close to animals and was familiar with excrements of all sorts of beasts.
Covered in it, so to speak.
Yeah, I mean, you know, it was just part of everyday life, and it was considered to be an important resource. You know, we didn't try and flush it away. It went back on the fields and so forth. At that time, what happened to me? Do you really want the truth?
No. I want you to lie to me. Of course I want the truth.
Okay, well, I'll tell you the truth. What happened? When I was a child, I noticed in my own stools little wiggly worms, these Enterobius pinworms, and I was really amazed by that. but rather a shame, because in my household where I grew up, it was not a very easy, relaxed household, and I just didn't feel right about telling my parents about this. So I kept it a secret all my childhood.
Oh.
I had these worms, and eventually discovered that there was a branch of knowledge, biology, which would tell you about things like this. So I studied that with great vigor, because I wanted to find out what they were and whether I was going to die or whether it was okay.
Did you cure yourself?
No, I didn't actually. What happened?
Still got them then?
No, because what happened was when I got married, you see...
Uh-huh. Did you tell her?
Yes, and that was my mistake. That was the downfall. My wife couldn't cope with this at all. And she, quite understandably, I think. I mean, I don't think she's a nutter or anything to have made this point. And so we had to take the medicine and get rid of my little friends. But I really did consider them to my little friends, and that's what drew me into the subject. And I studied zoology at a degree level and parasitology in detail. So that's how I got the background information, and then I discovered archaeology.
I can't stand it. My little friends. Somebody here just said every boy needs a pet.
I think that's true. But you see, my point is that I think it is important that you take this on board, that for the human condition is, and indeed for the condition of all other animals, is to have these intestinal nematodes. It is a perfectly normal thing in nature. And it's only today in our modern worlds, with high living and lavatories and decent water, that we don't have them. I'm not suggesting everybody ought to have them. I think we're much better off without them. But in many ways, it's a normal thing. And some of the complaints that we get today, things like hay fever and allergic complaints, certain parasitologists are claiming is because we don't have a decent suite of parasites for our immune systems to fight against. Huh. And so that we become hypersensitized. So the first thing that comes into us, a bit of pollen, bang, it all goes off, wallop. Whereas if we had a parasite burden, perhaps it wouldn't happen.
Well, wasn't that enlightening? Food for thought, maybe? Or at least fodder for your next big dinner party to keep your guest enthralled. Now we're going to move on to the next item. And before we're done, we're going to have, in addition to this one coming up, our usual visit with the Baxters and a little sing-along with Old MacDonald. But right now, let's go to an interview with Easter Bunny. Now, I know we're late, but this just came up as a reminder to me a few weeks ago that we missed Easter. Well, since we can do Christmas about 6 months in advance, why not do Easter 11 months in advance or more, depending on when it comes in the calendar next year? Anyway, Santa Claus has had his due, but has anybody ever talked to the Easter Bunny? Well, leave it to the CBC. It's going to be done right before your very ears. It was done actually a few years ago, but you'll hear it now if you haven't heard it before. Courtesy of Max Ferguson, we head down to the Burrow of the Easter Bunny, and after which I'll give you a bit of information about Max. Not that you really care, but hey, it's my show.
Good evening, Canada. This is Bob and Bella Bell speaking to you from the entrance of an underground burrow down in the ice fields of the South Pole. And I have beside me the person or thing, I don't know quite how to address him, for which I have come these many, many miles to interview. I would like to introduce, ladies and gentlemen, the Easter Bunny. Sir, or rather, Bunny, I suppose, how long have you been living down here at the South Pole?
Well, I've been down here ever since I got the Easter egg concession. You see, me biggest rival is old Santa Claus. Boy, he ain't got no use for me, that guy. You see, years and years ago, this would be upwards of 50 years ago, I used to work for old Fat.
You mean Santa?
Yeah, well, okay, Santa. I was one of his little elves up there at the North Pole, making toys all year round. And a couple of, about 50, 60 years ago, I got fed up. Well, I mean, there's no chance of advancement. There's no five-day week. And all them other smart little elves and smart elecs and little elves and gnomes there, they was making fun of me, and I had me fill of it.
Excuse me, why would the other elves be making fun of you?
Well, I was the only rabbit.
Oh, I see. You didn't, there was no metamorphosis, you didn't...
No, there wasn't. I was a rabbit up there, and of course, you know, the way American people are, they start to taunt me. So I start out on me own. I just said, if Santa can build up this whole Christmas thing, I'm going to do the same thing. And I looked around for a national holiday. I thought maybe Mother's Day I'd work on. That was no good. Bastille Day, we went right down the list, and finally we hit on Easter. So I took with me, I left Santa's bench, never forgave me for this, and I took about 10 of his best little elves, and we got a patent, we took it out on the Easter egg, and we set up down here at the South Pole. I want to be exactly the opposite, old Santa.
May I ask you this, Sir Bonnie? How does Easter compare with Christmas as far as popularity and public enthusiasm go?
Well, of course, you got to remember, in all fairness to myself, that that old slob there, he's got about 6 centuries head start on me.
You mean Santa?
Yeah, old slob, Santa. He knows when he's got a good thing going for him, and he never lets up. He never lets up. Boy, he's going... He's going 52 weeks a year, this guy, working on Christmas and building it up. But you give me, another 25 years, we'll catch him. Sure as fate, we'll catch him.
Well, I'd like to thank you very much, sir. Sorry, Bunny, for letting me talk to you on this roving reporter broadcast.
Well, it's been a pleasure. I'd like to give you as an egg to take back to your kids or something, but like I say, I mean, we've only been in the business about 50 years. We're building it up, and, of course, we're just sort of feeling our way along. You know, things, we're not too flush, old.
Don't worry about giving me an egg at all. You don't have to feel badly about that. Well, we'd like again to say thank you very much, sir, Bunny. It's hard to know just what to call you.
Call me anything at all. Anything at all. I'm not hard to get along with. Oh, ho, ho, Merry Easter. Oh, ho, ho, Merry Easter.
Well, this is Marvin Millibell returning you from the South Pole to our studios.
Well, just a few words about Max, because this is an example of a career that came almost by accident and shows you that you never turn down an opportunity or know where it's going to lead. He came out of World War II, decided to go into radio, went to the CBC, and they hired him and stuck him into a backwater town in Nova Scotia. Not that we don't like Nova Scotians, but it is very rural in that province. And being rural, they were wonderful country and western fans. He got stuck, as most neophytes do, in the early morning shift on a small station playing country and western music. He detested country and western music to the point where he couldn't tolerate it, but he had to eat. So what do? He came up with an alter ego, our friend Rawhide, which we can talk about some other time, but Rawhide got him through those shifts. The neat part about Rawhide was that he was not a CBC employee. They couldn't fire him. Rawhide got away with saying things Max would only think about. The weird part was, the loyal Hank Snow fans out there loved it. CBC loved it. They promoted them to Toronto. And that got him started on a career of about 50-plus years at CBC, where he came up with the Max Ferguson Show every morning. It aired about 7:30 in the Atlantic Zone, where he recorded it at the CBC, and then it went across the network at local times. And what he did was unique for its time, and actually when you hear this, you may think a bit of Bob and Ray. How he did this was, he came into the studio in the darkness hours of the morning, grabbed the newspapers, and perused them. He'd find something that tickled his imagination, some news item. Then he went to work, figuring out, in his head, what to do with it. He would get a brief conference with a producer, and maybe the sound man to get a few special effects. But basically, nobody knew, even him sometimes, what was going to happen until he opened the mic and went for it. He was able to characterize everybody from the Queen to the Prime Minister to sports figures to almost anybody. And it worked. He made a career out of this. So the Easter Bunny was one of those. Marvin Millibell, well, he was sort of the Canadian Wally Ballou in that he was the sort of quintessential stuffed shirt CBC announcer. Like Bob and Ray, Max was kind of an improvisationist and did not have scripts and such, which sometimes caused a little bit of nervousness on the part of CBC executives, but he survived it. And that's what happened. There he be. And before we leave this, one of those little things that you remember from broadcasting school and forget when you go to do your work. Here's a little clip from the CBC of an interview, and it tells you that you should always not just prepare for the interview, but be aware of your environment. sometimes it's just not appropriate to do an interview if things aren't just set right. As follows.
Your orchestra's cut down a little bit.
Yeah, we're back to the old trio, which I had for 1-2 years ago. But I enjoy it very much, because it gives me a lot of freedom myself.
We're being interrupted, I think.
You have an important question?
Well, there's a first in radio. That's, no, we're not coast to coast. In fact, I doubt if we're even local anymore. And I think they're... If any columnists are listening...
That's the first for your show.
And it could be the last.
This is the CBC Radio Network.
Well, there's a reminder of what not to do. If you need to take advantage of the suggestion made by that child, before we do our next segment, run quickly and do so. Because what's coming next is our usual visit with the Baxters, with Bob and Peg, in the little things in life.
It's not nice to eavesdrop, but it's fun. So let's check in on the comedy of errors at the Baxters. On the Little Things in Life, brought to you by Ban Roll-On, America's leading roll-on antiperspirant. Do you think all antiperspirants are basically the same? Well, Ban Roll-On antiperspirant may just change your mind. Take effectiveness, for instance. Tests have shown that Ban Roll-On antiperspirant will actually help stop wetness better than most leading sprays. Make your own test soon. Pick up a bottle of Ban Roll-On, and you may discover what we've shown in tests. Ban Roll-On antiperspirant, proof that not all antiperspirants are created equal.
Every woman likes to know she's the best she can be, so take a little time out for yourself, your looks, and especially for great-looking hair. Great-looking hair comes easily with Natural Wear Miss Clairol Hair Color. Choose from two personal formulas. Shampoo formula, our conditioning formula, is the easy way to get fresh, young color. Extra Rich Cream formula is the one hairdressers use, because no laboratory today has found a better way to cover gray. Shampoo formula or cream formula, try Natural Wear Miss Clairol to know you're the best you can be.
Where in the world have you been? I have phoned everywhere, dear.
Oh, down to the village in the hardware store.
Open today, Founder's Day?
Well, just for 2 hours. And since we're going out to the lake, I wanted to get some screening for those windows at the cottage.
Oh, forget the lake, forget the cottage. I don't think we're going.
Well, aren't the folks coming? Did Mother call?
They're coming, but we have to change plans. Mrs. Bradley called.
Mrs. Bradley?
Your boss's wife?
Mrs. Bradley
called, and she is out of her mind.
There's no news to me. Boy, that woman drives me up a wall.
Well, today she's going to drive you not only up the wall, but across the ceiling and down the other side, if I know you. It seems that Paul Revere was rushed to the hospital this morning and had his appendix out. Mrs. Bradley is wild, and she wants you to
what
take over...
What are you talking about?
Mrs. Bradley said you knew all about it.
I don't know anything about it.
Well, you know Mrs. Bradley's head of the Bicentennial Committee.
Oh, yeah, that. Yeah, I guess so, yeah.
You guess so? She said you came to a Chamber of Commerce meeting, dear, and that you all had a big discussion about today's celebration.
Oh, yes, yes, yes. Well, I didn't pay much attention. She just went on and on.
You don't remember anything about Paul Revere's ride that's going to be reenacted and the Minutemen meeting the Redcoats on the Green? Oh, honey, even the newspaper's been full of all the plans.
Well, honey, you know me. I don't go in for all that stuff, and
yeah,
I
do know you. You know, I bet you sat in that meeting and just made funny remarks to your pals and paid no attention to Mrs. Bradley, didn't
probably.
You?
Probably.
Yes, probably.
Well, listen, she gets so carried away
you
can't...
Mrs. Bradley's sending over your costume. I wrote down the directions for the route you take. Now, what did I do with them? Where are
what costume?
I'll have to drive you to Catonsville where you pick up the horse.
What horse?
Paul Revere rode a horse, remember? Through the countryside, shouting, "The British are coming, the British are coming."
Now, wait a minute. What does that have to do with me?
I just told you, honey. She wants you to be Paul Revere.
Never. Never.
No, she's tried everyone else. She couldn't reach people. It's such late notice. Some have gone off for the weekend. Others said they couldn't do it or they wouldn't do it.
Well, I don't want to be Paul Revere either, and I won't.
Now,
I'd feel ridiculous. On top of everything, I'd fall off a horse.
I told you hadn't been on a horse for ages.
Well, listen, I absolutely refuse to get into that.
I tried to get you out of it. How much could I say when she's your boss's wife? I said I would ask you. That's all I said. And she was just hysterical. She said, oh, he has to do it. I have to do it. I'll send over the costume right away. And then she just hung up.
I will quit my job before I will doll up like Paul Revere and gallop through the countryside shouting the British are coming.
Well, that is up to you. But considering the unemployment situation...
Now, honey, I can't do it. I wasn't kidding. I will fall off the horse.
Darling, you don't have to gallop through the countryside. Surely you'll stay on if you just ride the horse and hang on to the saddle. Well, let me tell you what it involves anyway while you're thinking. You start at Catonsville, ride to Whitman Corners, then pick up the old canal path right into Houston Park where the Minutemen will be assembled on the green. Now, you know where the old canal path is.
No.
Well, Mrs. Bradley's sending a map of the route, too. Oh, good heavens, don't get lost. You know what the local newspaper would do with that? Paul Revere lost, British win war, or something cute like that.
Well, I don't see why Mrs. Bradley picks on me.
Well, I knew there was something. It's a rule of the Bicentennial Committee that Paul Revere has to be someone whose ancestors actually fought in Lexington. At the meeting, she said she asked who had revolutionary ancestors, and you raised your hand.
What?
Did you?
Yes.
Well?
Yes, I did.
Yes. Well, this is typical, dear. One of your funny little jokes that backfired then. Well, call her up, admit it, and just see what she says.
I did have an ancestor who fought at Lexington.
You did? Well, you never told me that. Really? Never. You have never... You never told me that.
Have.
Never.
I used to get so sick and tired of my Aunt Ruth boasting about it all the time. Well, maybe I didn't tell you.
But that's exciting. Well, there's the car stopping out in front. Must be somebody with a costume. Yes, it is. Yes, it is. That's your costume. Well, you'll have to make up your mind fast, dear. Oh, honey, your parents would be so proud of you.
Not if I fall off the horse.
Oh, you're not going to fall off the horse. You'll get your picture in the paper. You'll be interviewed since your ancestor did fight at Lexington. I think it is your patriotic duty, and I would be really very proud of you, honey.
Well, if you put it that way...
That's your costume. Now, Paul Revere, you get upstairs, shower and shave, and get your clothes on before the British arrive ahead of you.
In my house, we've got a fully automatic kitchen. Me. And the worst job I've got to do is scrape and scrub that dirty oven.
Well, there's a different way to clean your oven that's less work. The overnight way, with Mr. Muscle.
Promises, promises.
It's true. With Mr. Muscle, you just spray it on at night, and while you sleep, its self-scouring foam lifts up the grease and grime.
That's a good idea.
So next morning, you just wipe clean.
You know, I've got a feeling that Mr. Muscle's going to be a good man to wake up to.
I sweep my floor, and I still hear sugar underfoot. I hate that straw broom.
That's the kind of dirt straw brooms miss. But an Oseeder angler broom would get it. Angler bristles are cut on an angle to keep more tips on the floor, and the tips are closer together. Oseeder angler gets the dirt other brooms miss.
Oseeder makes your life easier.
What do you hear from your floor?
Not a sound.
Oseeder makes your life easier.
You look marvelous.
Yeah? I feel a little silly. His knee pants.
Shoes with the silver buckles are gorgeous.
My wig itches.
Well, it looks great. Put the hat on now. You look marvelous. I love that shirt with the big full sleeves. I wish I had one like it.
I wonder if my ancestor looked like this.
Probably.
Actually, you know something? It isn't until you get dressed up like this that you begin to understand, begin to realize about the beginning of America, how it started.
Uh-huh.
I never thought that much about it before, not really. I think Americans, most of us, take what we have for granted, pretty much, forgetting what the colonists went through.
Yes. Now stop looking at yourself in the mirror. Come on, you ready now so I can show your mother what you look like? Your folks came while you were showering. I didn't tell them a thing. I wanted you to surprise them.
Oh, where are they?
Well, your mother's downstairs having some lemonade. Come on, Debbie drove your dad down to the store for something while it's still open. Don't trip now going down the stairs.
No. I'll try not to. Shoot you a little big. Oh, mother! Get a load of your baby boy.
Look at him.
Good heavens! What are you doing in that getup?
Going to be Paul Revere today, going through the countryside shouting, "The British are coming, the British are coming."
The bicentennial celebration at the park today, Mother.
Well, look at you, aren't you something? But how come you're going to be Paul Revere?
Well, they asked me.
They had to have someone, Mother, who had an ancestor at Lexington.
And today I shall distinguish the family if I don't fall off that horse.
Oh, oh, stop it. Mother, he won't fall off now, don't worry. Anyhow, he doesn't have to ride too far.
Yes, but I don't understand why.
Mother, it's all being reenacted historically.
The Minutemen will be on the green facing the British.
Yes, I understand. I get all that. You know, I wish something... Sometimes you wouldn't treat me as though I didn't have all my marbles just because I'm over 65.
Mother, we don't feel...
Oh, yes, you do. But what I want to say is... If you're going to be so historical, why are you Paul Revere? I mean, why are you going to be fighting on the wrong side?
What? What?
You, mean?
You know your great-great-great-grandfather was a Tory.
Tory?
Yes.
Redcoat?
Yes, he was captured and shot. Not at Lexington, but later.
Captured and shot?
Yes, dear. Oh, your Aunt Ruth always pretended otherwise, but it wasn't true. He was a Tory, and the family has never talked about it much, you know, for that reason.
A red coat.
Better call Mrs. Bradley.
Well, if you don't say anything, she'll never know the difference. Now, we've...
No, I can't do that, no.
She won't know the difference, and it is so...
I don't care. I can't do it. I feel like a spy.
Oh, for heaven's sake, darling, a spy.
Well, a traitor, then. Yeah, I would. Masquerading as Paul Revere when underneath I'm a red coat, loyal to King George.
Oh, son, it's been so long ago, it doesn't matter now.
Well, it's the whole point of the bicentennial.
An hour ago, you didn't care about the bicentennial.
Well, I do now. I mean, I care enough not to betray my country.
Oh, your country? Which country? England or America?
I don't know.
What are you talking about, dear?
How come that guy was a redcoat and you never told me, Mother?
Well, I thought I did tell you after you grew up, but your Aunt Ruth always thought it should be a secret.
Didn't he understand what the colonies were fighting for? Liberty, freedom, no taxation without representation?
Well, he came from England. I suppose his family was still back there. He was a soldier. It was his duty to be loyal to King George.
Well, look, let's not fight the revolution all over again. Now, we've got this Mrs. Bradley. I forgot to call her back and say that you'll do
it. Well, I can't do it now.
Well, you'll have to do it. Hello? Hello? Mrs. Bradley? Yes, yes, the costume came, dear, and he's... What? Drummer boy came down, if I can't understand. Chicken pox?
Hey, let me have the phone. I'll explain to her exactly
Mrs. Bradley,
why I can't...
Don't worry. I'm sure everything is going to go fine now. Don't cry. I'm sure it will... Yes, we'll be there. Goodbye, Mrs. Bradley.
Well, don't hang up.
She hung up. She was absolutely hysterical. Now, everything has gone wrong for that woman. Somebody has misplaced the rifles. The British have collected in the wrong park. Nobody can find the Elks drum corps for the parade. I could not tell her that you wouldn't do it. Where's your mother?
She's mad. She went outside to tell Dad all about
it. Well, apologize to her. And then let's get to Catonsville. You're due on the green at 11:35, at which time they'll fire the shot heard round the world. If they can find the rifles, I guess.
red coat. Oh, I dressed up like Paul Revere. I do feel like a spy.
Oh, honey, well, don't tell anyone. Look at it this way. As Paul Revere, you're making up for your great-great-great-grandfather. You are loyal to the colonies.
Hey, you're right. All right, come on. Yeah. Oh, boy, I hope I stay on the horse.
Little Things in Life has been brought to you by the O-Cedar Angler Broom. It gets the dirt other brooms miss. This is the Serial Network.
And we're about ready to wrap up, so I'm giving Louise about a 3 or 4 minute head start. But first, let's have a little sing-along with Old MacDonald. I don't know where I came across this. Somebody must have sent this to me, because I'm not smart enough to find this on my own. But here it is. Get your voices limbered up, and we're going to have a little time with Old MacDonald's Farm. You all know how that works. And, of course, this one will be a bit different, as you will hear right about now.
Conducting experiments in laboratories recently with cloning and DNA. In fact, they are able to clone in, to program in certain deformities into animals so that they can experiment on them and possibly find a cure for these ailments. And they developed a frog with no head just before Christmas. It'll probably get elected to Congress. And they've come up with some other really strange creatures. Now, they have to have somewhere to keep these animals. They can't just keep them in the lab for obvious reasons. So an old farmer, famous in folk song, came out of retirement, offered the use of his farm and his services to keep these animals. His name?
Farmer Nadell.
not Farmer in the Dell. Old MacDonald. Old MacDonald had a deformed farm, E-I-E-I-O. And on that farm he had a lisping snake, E-I-E-I-O. With a hiff hiff here and a hiff hiff there, here a hiff, there a hiff, everywhere a hiff hiff. Old MacDonald had a deformed farm, E-I-E-I-O. Now old MacDonald had a deformed farm, E-I-E-I-O. And on that farm he had a hare-lipped dog, E-I-E-I-O. With a mark, mark here, and a mark, mark there. Here a mark, there a mark, everywhere. Mark, mark, hit, hit here, hit, hit there. Here a hit, there a hit, everywhere a hit, hit. Old MacDonald had a deformed farm, E-I-E-I-O. Now old MacDonald had a deformed farm, E-I-E-I-O. And on that farm he had a stuttering cow, E-I-E-I-O. With a moo-moo here and a moo-moo there. Here a moo, there a moo, everywhere a mark-mark here, mark-mark there. Here a mark, there a mark, everywhere. Mark-mark, hit-hit here, hit-hit there. Here a hit, there a hit, everywhere a hit-hit. Old MacDonald had a deformed farm, E-I-E-I-O. Old MacDonald had a deformed farm, E-I-E-I-O. And on that farm he had a dyslexic sheep, E-I-E-I-O. With an ab-ab here and an ab-ab there. Here an ab, there an ab, everywhere an ab-ab. Im-im-im, im-im-im, moo-moo here, moo-moo there. Here a moo, there a moo, everywhere a mark-mark here, mark-mark there. Here a mark, there a mark, everywhere. Mark, mark, hit, hit here, hit, hit there. Here a hit, there a hit, everywhere a hit, hit. Old MacDonald had a deformed farm, E-I-E-I-O. Old MacDonald had a deformed farm, E-I-E-I-O. And on that farm he had a narcoleptic pig, E-I-E-I-O. With a here and a there, here a there, a, everywhere a. Ab-ab here, ab-ab there, here an ab, there an ab, everywhere an ab-ab. Im-im-im-im, moo-moo here, moo-moo-moo there. Here a moo, there a moo, everywhere a mark-mark here, mark-mark there. Here a mark, there a mark, everywhere. Mark-mark, hit-hit here, hit-hit there. Here a hit, there a hit, everywhere a hit-hit. Old MacDonald had a deformed farm, E-I-E-I-O. Old MacDonald had a deformed farm, E-I-E-I-O. And on that farm he had a Tourette syndrome chicken, E-I-E-I-O. With a buck buck here and a buck buck there, here a buck, there a buck, buck here, there, here, there, everywhere. Ab ab here, ab ab there, here an ab, there an ab, everywhere an ab ab. Me, moo moo here. Moo-moo there, here up, moo, there up, moo, everywhere up. Mark-mark here, mark-mark there, here a mark, there a mark, everywhere. Mark-mark, hit-hit here, hit-hit there. Here a hit, there a hit, everywhere a hit-hit. Old MacDonald had a deformed farm, E-I-E-I-O. Old MacDonald had a deformed farm, E-I-E-I-O. And on that farm he had a perverted frog, E-I-E-I-O. With a rubbit rubbit here and a rubbit rubbit there. Here a rubbit, there a rubbit, everywhere a rubbit rubbit. Buck buck here, buck buck there. Here a buck, there a buck, tuck. Here, there, here, there, everywhere. Ab ab here, ab ab there. Here an ab, there an ab, everywhere an ab ab. Mark, mark here, mark, mark there. Here a mark, there a mark, everywhere. Mark, mark, hiss, hiss here, hiss, hiss there. Here a hiss, there a hiss, everywhere a hiss, hiss. Old MacDonald had a deformed farm, E-I-E-I-O. Now old MacDonald had a deformed farm, E-I-E-I-O. And on that farm he had a drug-dealing duck, E-I-E-I-O. with a crack, crack here, and a crack, crack there. Here a crack, there a crack, everywhere. Crack, crack, rub it here. Rub it there. Here a rub it, there a rub it, everywhere. Rub it, buck, buck here, buck, buck there. Here a buck, there a buck. Here, there, here, there, everywhere. Ab, ab here, ab, ab there, here and ab, there and ab, everywhere and ab, ab. Me, 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 moo, moo here, moo, moo there, here up, moo, there, moo, everywhere up. Marf, marf here, marf, marf there, here a marf, there a marf, everywhere. Marf, marf, hiss, hiss here, hiss, hiss there. Here a hiss, there a hiss, everywhere a hiss, hiss. Old MacDonald had a deformed farm. E-I-E-I-O.
Well, as Joy would say about this time, that's all the time we've got for this time. I hope you had fun with this. I had a lot of fun putting it together. It was something I hadn't planned on, and it just sort of fit, and I hope it fits your style as well. If not, give me another try in a few weeks. We'll do something differently. In the meantime, and here we go again, giving Luis a chance to snagger over to the microphone. Right after the theme, Luis, well, do your thing. Okay, so get ready. In the meantime, folks, thanks for being here. It does make it worthwhile for me to do things like that when there's somebody to hear it. And until we meet again, as usual, we always say, and mean, good listening, good night, good luck, and goodbye. Okay, Luis, finish it up. Right after the theme, of course.
I love to listen to my radio. Gee, how it thrills me when I hear it go. Someday you'll hear it
soon. Okay, Rotten Rick. My goodness, man, you've stunk the joint up enough for tonight. So allow me to whip out my can of air freshener and start spraying things down, because it is that time when we need to wrap it up and put it to bed for this week's broadcast of Michael's Saturday Night Surprise, or en español, El Sorpreso de Miguel de la Noche Sábado. But, as always, if any of you have any comments, complaints, requests, or any of that stuff, please address it to the Michael Saturday Night Surprise director, Miguel Amato, at michaemeli@earthlink.net. That is MIKEAMELI @earthlink.net. Yep, you've all might have guessed it by now, but we will soon be releasing the key and turning over the room to you, the listening audience. Please do with it as you wish, for as long as you wish. But just remember, be nice to one another. Otherwise, we'll just have to get his rottenness to unleash another one of his patented stink bombs. And who knows? Maybe even the MSS director might decide to pull the plug on you guys if you don't behave. And of course, without me, well, enough said about that. So, on behalf of myself and the rest of the MSS crew, I hope that each and every one of you have a great weekend, a great night, and as usual, good night, folks. Take it easy, and we are done.